Good morning, everyone. A unique opportunity has been given to us in this fall series to actually see and hear our author talking about the book that we're studying in a video that we're able to share with our Zoom community today. And in fact, we're going to see two videos that will help place Sister Joan Chittister right into our midst this morning. The first video was made available to us by one of our upcoming speakers, Judith Valenti. Judith interviewed Sister Joan several years ago for the program Religion and Ethics when she was working for PBS. The interview takes place at the Mount St. Benedictine Monastery in Erie, Pennsylvania. Judith's well-chosen questions draw forth a warm and colorful introduction to Sister Joan. So let's engage in a little time traveling and listen in as Judith introduces us to Joan, giving us a sense of what she was about in the year 2013. Would you take it and roll with it, Jim? Thanks.
If I awaken to the morning sun, I am grateful.
This is a key part of Sister Joan Chittister's life, praying the Psalms daily with others in her Benedictine monastic community. And this too is her life, writing. She has written more than 40 books on the spiritual life that together have sold over 1 million copies. Her often provocative statements, she has called the Catholic Church, quote, one of the last bastions of sexism, and characterized its position on abortion as more pro-birth than pro-life, have made her a heroine to some, a rebel to others. She is also a familiar face at public protests, speaking out against nuclear arms, war, and poverty.
I have a disease called justice, and I can spot injustice at a great distance and feel compelled to confront it.
She has long advocated for Catholic women's ordination and a greater voice for lay people. And she has rankled her church's hierarchy on a host of other issues. Scrutiny of women religious.
Terrible, unacceptable, divisive, and unnecessary.
Ongoing revelations of sexual abuse and the cover-up by hierarchy.
An infection in the body of the church.
The shortage of priests.
We don't have a shortage of priests. We have a shortage of celibate males.
Gay marriage.
Obviously a social issue that needed to be addressed.
She says that society is rapidly changing and that all churches need to address those changes.
To be reactionary at a time like this is to stand in front of a tsunami and say you can swim. We're changing. Our goal is to change for the better. The church has to model that changing for the better, not clinging to the past, but reforming the future. It is possible. It's been done multiple times in human history, and we have to stop resisting it now.
For the past 61 years, Sister Joan has been a member of Mount St. Benedict Monastery in Erie, Pennsylvania. She was educated by the Erie Benedictines and entered the monastery here at age 16.
On my 10th day of high school, and I said, Mom, there's something I want to tell you. And she said, what's that, honey? And I said, I've decided I'm going to be a Benedictine. She turned around and she said, you're going to do what?
A teenage battle with polio nearly derailed her dream of becoming a nun.
Those were the days when if you were ill, they didn't take you. So it took probably more nerve on their part than on mine. But it seems to me what has come down to me over the years is they were simply struck by the degree of commitment, and they couldn't bring themselves to send me home.
Over the years, she has become a spokeswoman for interfaith relations and has traveled the world on peacemaking missions. Sister Joan is perhaps best known for introducing 21st century readers to the 6th century rule of St. Benedict, a spiritual guide she says is as relevant today as when it was written. St. Benedict advocated a life of prayer and work and stressed the importance of hospitality, humility, and community. he wrote when the Roman Empire was in economic decline and under threat from outside forces, a time, the Benedictine sisters say, not unlike our own.
Benedict was trying to, in his day, show people that there was another way to go about life. Moderation in all things, balance in all things, certainly God at the center of all. We have been trying to make people aware that Benedictine spirituality is for all people, not just for religious women and men. And it has been from the beginning. I think Joan does that very well.
Benedictines take to this day a vow of stability. What's that mean? It means we're an eyrie for life. We go down with this city, or we build it up.
Once a thriving manufacturing city, Erie has for decades been battling an economic decline and is today one of the poorest cities in Pennsylvania. The Benedictine sponsor a variety of inner city ministries. This is an old tire factory the sisters transformed into the Art House, a place where children learn to play instruments, dance, write poetry, and paint. There is also the Emmaus Soup Kitchen that feeds more than 200 people a day, and a refugee center housed in what was once a Benedictine academy for girls.
Gracious God of the cosmos, we ask your blessing on all who work here.
On this day, the sisters gather to bless their most recent effort, The Grove, an urban farm with 65 raised beds that will provide fresh produce for the poor and serve as an outdoor classroom for teaching gardening techniques.
You cannot walk anywhere in our community and not see the footprint of the Benedictine sisters everywhere you go.
One of Sister Joan's newest and most cherished projects is the virtual monastery she and the other sisters have created for the internet. She calls the website the Monastery of the Heart.
We now have over 7,400 members from all around the globe. People who come into the site to pray in the morning. We have a prayer site. To pray in the evening, to join discussions, to read the basic books, and to talk about them. They're forming their own small communities, many of them. We have, I think, about 40 small communities now.
Noting how Benedictines have often adapted to changing times in their 1,500-year history, Sister Joan says of her Monastery of the Heart website,
if Benedict of Nursia had been here, not only do I think he'd be a member, I think he would have started it.
It is that kind of visionary leadership, she says, that the church itself needs to survive in the 21st century.
Why do you stay in the Catholic Church?
Roman Catholicism is the storehouse, the treasure house of the Christian tradition. It's this whole notion of the blend of wisdom, of commitment, of knowledge, of holiness. That's the church for me. That's the church I'm waiting for.
In the meantime, she vows to continue writing, pressing for change, and speaking out against injustice. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Tim. In the years following that interview, Joan and her sisters watched our nation spiral into social chaos, both morally and spiritually. Her outrage and concern found their way into the powerful book that we are reading together this fall, The Time Is Now. And she's calling it us in its pages to engage with what's going on with uncommon courage. The book became a bestseller, and not surprisingly, was picked up by Oprah Winfrey as the centerpiece of one of her Super Soul Sunday programs 2 years ago. We're able to see it this morning thanks to Facebook's public domain policy. And you will be able to see both of these videos again when our webmaster, Dennis Rivers, posts it on our website a couple of days after today. Probably it'll be up by maybe Saturday. Now, because Word in Life is based in Santa Barbara, it's a particular pleasure to see this interview taking place on our own home ground. In an oak grove on the east side of Oprah's home in Montecito, less than a mile down creek from the well-known retreat center, La Casa de Maria. Here we see two extraordinary women, each in her own way, living out a life of what Sister Joan calls a spiritual practice. It's called prophecy. This is a riveting 40 minutes of burning questions, asked and answered by two of the most significant voices speaking today to a culture that has lost its way, and asking us to add our own voices to the work of recovering a desire for the common ground. So you're about to sit down on a grassy slope under some oaks with Oprah and Joan. Thanks, Tim. Take it away.
Has a question for you.
Whatever happened to our souls, Oprah? Yeah,
yeah. Preach, Sister Joan, preach.
Today on Super Soul Sunday, scholar, social activist, and best-selling author, Sister Joan Chittister is back.
We're in a complete collapse and crisis of American values.
Whoa. When she was last here in 2015, Sister Joan proved she is unlike any other nun I've ever met.
I have said for years, and mean it quite sincerely, Jesus was a feminist.
In her latest book, The Time Is Now, A Call to Uncommon Courage, Sister Joan defines what it means to be a prophet in today's modern world.
Only a moral national conversation can bring us through to another level of political humanity as well as spiritual humanity.
The conversation was a wake-up call for me.
I was so moved by this book and so proud of you for having the courage to tell us how we are headed for real despair.
Now in the midst of what she calls a crisis of American values, Sister Joan says we all have to ask ourselves, what are we going to do about it?
Not only are we going in the wrong direction, we have simply abandoned the right direction. And the right direction is where we came from.
May I say you look healthier, stronger, and more vibrant and radiant than you did the last time we sat down here 4 or 5 years ago?
Well, I think that's right. I'm much healthier now.
Yeah, I can feel it.
Yes.
I can sense that you are.
And I swim every day.
You still? I was going to ask you, were you leaving this conversation and you're flying to go to a speaking engagement,
that's right.
82 years old.
Yeah.
What gives you your energy?
I don't want to be corny, but it is life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I live for the fulfillment of life, not just in myself, but in others. So when I get up in the morning, I always have a goal. I think purpose is the definition of the life well lived.
I believe that so strongly. And you've written over 50 books, and this one, I think, is designed for this moment in time. It's called The Time Is Now, A Call to Uncommon Courage. And I can feel from the writing of it that there was something in you that was driven to write this. What happened?
Well, what happened is what's happening in the United States. I feel very strongly that the country as a country and the globe as a globe is at a crossover moment in time.
Yes.
And I've been dealing with that phrase in my head for 4 or 5 years now. We have already left one form of life that you and I were taught from first grade on and is now disappearing in front of our eyes to something new that is new but has no true north.
Yes.
It has no moral compass. It gives us no direction. What it does is shatter everything we've been told all of our lives could not be shattered. And I'll tell you the truth, Oprah, I don't want to go to my grave and on that last sickbed say to myself, and you said nothing. So I just decided I would write that book, throw it out there, make that statement about what I think is happening, what I think we must do to confront it, and then I'll at least know that somehow or other,
you said
I didn't let it go by in silence.
Yes.
There's too much silence going on in this country.
Yes.
Because, you see, we've been taught that this can't happen to us. And so we're waiting for either the vending machine God to save us, or this great constitutional structure to curb. Yes. It's not curbing anything. Yeah.
And I think it goes beyond, because I think it's easy for the left to blame the right and to say all of this is happening because of the man in office. It's easy for the people who are holding the office to say, oh, it's those liberals. And the truth is, we got here because of all of us.
Yes, and we got here on half a paddle. I'm arguing that one of the reasons we're in this and don't know how to get out of it.
Can you describe what we're in?
Yes, we're in a complete collapse and crisis of American values.
Whoa.
Everything we took for granted, civility, which is the basis for respect for other people.
Yeah, it's just common sense manners.
Just common sense manners. The whole notion that character is a component of leadership.
Yes.
We're all functional and pragmatic now.
Right.
As long as it works here for me, that's all we need to have to know. We are losing a sense of the common good. I get up with this thing ringing in my head, you know, I don't think it's historically true, but it's attached. If they don't have bread, let them eat cake. Only we're saying, well, let them get a job, like I did.
Yes.
Without a single notion that there's a whole body of the population for whom there are no jobs left.
Right. Or let them find asylum someplace else.
Because
we're full. We're full.
Yeah, we're full.
We're full.
We're full. And you know who's saying that? The immigrant families who came here because they would be welcomed, because there would be an opportunity for them. So I'm saying we've lost the rudder.
Yeah.
And we don't have another. So where shall we look for it?
Now, it's so interesting because everybody feels this, or at least many of the people that I know feel it. There are a lot of people whose pocketbooks have been expanded with our current administration. So they're feeling like, what does it matter if my pocketbook looks good?
Oh,
yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, there are a lot of people.
As long as the economy stays good, of an imperial presidency. And it didn't just start here. You're dead right.
What is upsetting to me is that people have gotten lost in Trumpism and blaming the current administration. And so it allows people to be stalled and also silenced and do nothing, because you can just shift the blame to one person. But it is not about one person.
No, it's not about, I'm not sure it's about person at all,
to
be quite frank. I believe that part of our problem, at least, lies in the fact that we have lost half the dimension of Christian spirituality. We see ourselves as very Christian people.
Yes. I think most of the country still defines itself that
way. Oh, that's right. They do. There's a consciousness in us. This is a Christian nation.
Yes.
And I suddenly realized, who is the Jesus that we like to follow? We love to follow Jesus the healer.
Mm-hmm.
Makes us feel good.
Yes.
Jesus was good to women, raised little kids from the dead, talked to babies, fed whole hungry crowds. That's who I am. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, we want to follow that Jesus.
That Jesus.
Yes.
Jesus the healer.
Yes.
But that's half the Christian dispensation. You turn Jesus the healer over, and what you find is Jesus the prophet. This is the Jesus who contended, contested, confronted, and challenged those who were making it necessary to feed the hungry, to raise from the dead, to give some dignity to. We've lost.
Who weren't willing to do that.
Weren't willing.
And he was speaking up for the underdog.
That's exactly right.
Right.
But we have lost that whole notion of prophetic spirituality.
Yes. I love that you start the book with a word about prophets. So the book, which I hope you all will give yourself the time and the sacred moment to explore, is called The Time Is Now, A Call to Uncommon Courage. But this, I particularly love the way you started. This book is about the prophet in you. A world gone badly askew stands on the cusp between authoritarianism and freedom, between universal compassion and national self-centeredness. national self-centeredness.
That's it.
We have become the, I can see it from certainly my point of view, the reality television nation that has a reality show going on constantly everywhere in our lives.
That's exactly right.
Yes. It is a world scarred with violence, you continue to say, institutionalized fraud, rapacious human degradation, political suppression, economic slavery, and rampant narcissism. We see it all around us and can't even...
It's becoming normative.
It's normalized, yes.
Yes, it's normalized. Yeah.
We're a selfie nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're a selfie nation.
And we're saying America first. For the very first time in the history of this country, America first in a global world. No matter what our development does to anybody else's development, we have no criteria, apparently, that will require us to ask what are the effects of our nation on the family of nation.
You continue to say it's a world in wait. It waits for some wise and wild voices to lead us back to spiritual sanity. Our world waits for you and me, for spiritual people everywhere, to refuse to be pawns in the destruction of a global world for the sake of national self-centeredness. I just love that phrase.
It's real.
It's real. I think that's a gift that you're giving us to articulate it so clearly. The only question is, will we take up what we know is our moral and spiritual responsibility, you say, to make the world a better place for all, to bring to life the fullness of creation for all, to bring about equality, safety, security, and compassion for all? That is where the prophet comes in. The prophet is the person who says no to everything that is not of God.
Try.
No to the abuse of women. No to the rejection of the stranger. No to crimes against immigrants. No to the rape of the trees. No to the pollution of the skies. No to the poisoning of the oceans. No to the despicable destruction of humankind for the sake of more wealth, more power, more control for a few. No, even to death.
That's right. That is, and why is the prophet...
Good for you. Good for you. Go, Sister Joan.
It's true.
That is so...
We're not even
poignantly
talking
expressed.
In those terms anymore.
No.
We're not
I don't
using...
think we know how bad it is. I think, you know, it reminds me of the beginning of Elie Wiesel's book, Night, where Moshe the Beatle is coming and trying to warn the people of what's ahead.
That's...
And no one can hear it.
That's...
No one can hear it.
No one can hear it.
So here you are, Moshe the Beatle, in the form of Sister Joan, trying to tell us what's ahead.
This is the work of the prophet, you see. As little kids, we learned one thing. There was one God. There was one God. Now, if you really believe that there is only one God, then you must believe that that one God is communicating these messages in all languages, in all terms, to all colors and all dialects everywhere. We're getting the same message about human unity, about care for one another. And yet, at the same time, we're tone deaf, except the prophet who stays sensitive to those words. There's one God who wills good for us all, and that God wills me to be part of that goodness for all. Therefore, I have to step up. I have to step up. I have to get into the human conversation.
Coming up.
You say on the very first page, even for the table contents, we need to reclaim our own moral compass as a people. We have a spiritual obligation to reshape a world run amok, with a world around us cracking at the seams and America in a state of polarization and political disarray. This book sets out to answer the most serious questions of them all. How do we really get out of the swamp we're in? So tell us, how do we get out of this is the real swamp. We're all in the swamp.
Oh,
the swamp
in the
isn't
swamp.
Just in Washington, D.C.
Well, I really believe it's the recovery
We're in the swamp because we've lost our moral way.
That's right. We have no true north.
We have no true north.
We don't know where we're going or why we're going there. We have no criterion on which to evaluate our own position.
And so can you share with our audience what that ultimately means? When you don't have a moral center, you don't have a compass, you don't have a true north, regardless of what it looks like. I think everybody thinks, oh, it's bad for a lot of people. It's bad for those people at the border, but I'm going to be okay. We're going to be okay because the economy's great.
Yes. When any institution upon which we depend begins to look like it's shaking in the wind or no longer the refuge that we took it to be, even if we're not sure why, two emotions arise in a group, anxiety and passivity. So even the people who know that they're doing well right now are also afraid that maybe tomorrow the next shoe is going to drop.
Absolutely. So, there's a low-level anxiety.
Anxiety.
Yeah.
And nobody gets hysterical.
Yeah.
Nobody rushes to the streets.
Yes.
Very few people speak up even to their families because we were trained to be nice. We were never trained to be good.
Yeah.
We're very genteel. But we are not prophetic. We are not honest. So what you get over here is the passivity that comes out of anxiety unexpressed. And that passivity leads to the silence that we're seeing now. Everybody knows that there's a storm coming from the north, but maybe it won't hit here. Mm. So we
preach, Sister Joan, preach. That is... God knows that's the truth.
Oh, it is true. I know it is so true. And I made up my mind. I don't know how much time is left in my own life, but I had to get this said so that it could be clear and at least it would be out there some way. Mm-hmm. Somebody saying, stop. Not only are we going in the wrong direction, we have simply abandoned the right direction. And the right direction is where we came from. We came from civility. We came from a care for common good. We came from compassion. We came as a democratic nation with the honor of compromise. And now we have a Congress without conscience. They won't even lean across the aisle. We have partisanship tearing us apart and embedded in our very national framework. Both of them.
Both sides.
Both sides.
Absolutely.
I'm not talking about us side.
Yeah.
I'm talking about an attitude. The prophetic spirituality is this contrary attitude. And the contrary attitude is not a set of specific, pietistic, well-meaning, good-feeling, religious little acts.
Okay. So prophetic spirituality. Daniel Bergen, one of the prophets of our time you write about in your beautiful book, who decried the Vietnam War and turned that into a lifelong path to peace for many, said this: the prophet is one who speaks the truth to a culture of lies. And while saying no, the prophet also says yes. Yes to equal rights for all. Yes to alleviating suffering. Yes to embracing the different. Yes to who God made you. Yes to life. And that's what prophetic spirituality is being able to step up to that.
And it is sensitivity to that will of God for all, not just for America, for all, for all of us. Yeah. The one God wishes us all well. I now have a moral, spiritual responsibility.
The one God by whatever name you choose
to call
him.
By whatever, I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care.
And I don't think he, it, she cares.
No, absolutely not.
Not at all. So the time is now for us to get ourselves out of the swamp. How do we begin to do that?
It's not so difficult. I'm not requiring anybody or even assuming that anybody should rush to the streets with placards. But I do think they should begin to become aware of what's going on around them. How do you do that? Let's say that there's a bill in Congress. How unusual. On medical care.
Yes.
How about that? We'll just guess at that, that someday we might be concerned about medical care, right? And so when I know that that bill is there and coming, I need to begin to study. That's the very first thing Isaiah did. The biblical prophet Isaiah was completely rejected by his society, the most militaristic period in Hebrew history, mm-hmm. and he couldn't get their attention. So did he call that a loss? No. He withdrew, he gathered groups around him, and he began to study and to prepare them. We have to study the legislation. We have to call our family together, call the club together, call the neighbor together, seven of you, five of you, and say, what are the implications of this? If this bill goes through, who will be affected? Who will be advantaged by it? Who will be disadvantaged by it? And then we have to magnify our voices. I tell people all the time, have you sent $5 to save the whales lately? If you haven't, don't complain to me about the loss of the waters of the oceans or the destruction of them. Get attached. Find your concern.
Right. You pick a cause, I say any cause.
Cause I don't care.
There's nowhere you can turn that there isn't one.
And it's all coming into the same place. Yes.
Coming up.
You write about our fear to risk, our fear of not being popular. You say there is risk to every life. Those who risk nothing risk much more. The Talmud teaches, while we keep our heads down, our mouths closed, our public reputations unblotted, thanks to the silence we keep in the face of great public issues of the day, pillars of society erode in front of us. The call to discern the difference between what is holy and what is simply unpopular, between what is and what should be, is of the essence of the good life.
That's right.
I think now it's like, people are afraid to speak up because you won't get as many likes. You will be blasted on Twitter. You will be called out, you know. I recently spoke up for something I believed in, and now all over Twitter, people are like, she's a snake. So to stand up for what you believe to be the truth and believe to be right, you take a big risk, particularly in the world of social media.
If you and I were Greek philosophers,
yes,
and we were sitting here together in 3rd century BC, we would be talking about the development of the human conversation. Mm-hmm. Human discourse, as you have just described it, mm-hmm. is over. It's over. It's all down to 64 or 144 little characters,
yes,
that allow you to disrespect another person's ideas or situation. Suddenly, the more tension, the more division, the more hatred you can spew, the higher your ratings. Whatever happened to our souls, Oprah?
Yeah. What you're saying here in The Time Is Now is that we have lost sight of our souls, is what you're really saying. And so important, because no one is calling that out.
Well, here's another thing that's blocking us subconsciously. Our pride as a nation, and I don't misunderstand, quite rightly, is the separation of church and state. But it has become now the separation of mind and soul. The whole notion that part of my spiritual development lies in my analysis of the effect of my society on everything around me is the measure of my moral value,
right,
in this society.
Yeah.
We love to talk about living as Jesus lived. But what we mean by that, apparently, is living as Jesus lived in the first century, rather than living as Jesus would be living in this century.
Ah.
Live as Jesus would live in this century.
Preach, Sister Joan. Yes, and I love what you say about the people who claim to be pro-life. They're pro-birth.
And I'll tell you why I know. Because they don't want any tax money to going to feeding that child, educating that child, housing that child. I say
we just want you to be born.
Yeah, just get born.
Just get born.
And then after that, you're on your own.
That's right.
We have no...
This is what I don't understand. The people who claim to be pro-life are also for tearing children from their mother's arms,
right,
at the border.
Because it's
makes
good
no
for
sense.
Them. It not good
no
for
sense.
The child.
Yeah.
Good for them at that moment.
Because people think, oh, okay, it's all right for me to do. I think this, you and I know that that spiritual law is also physical law.
That's right.
What's going out is coming back. You cannot
get away from it.
The 13th century mystic, Julian of Norwich. Everybody quotes her song, and all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of. If you read the entire sentence in her 13th shoeing,
yes,
she says, we must understand that God does not punish sin. Hang on. God does not punish sin. Sin punishes sin. Think about it.
Yes.
If pride is your sin, then you will never have enough adulation on the globe to be satisfied with. If lust is your sin, you will never have enough sex, enough men, enough women to fill up your sense of physical power.
Yes.
If anger is your sin, you'll die from the ulcers that burn inside you because you're always angry. God does not punish sin. Sin punishes sin. This is going to bite the heels out of us, Oprah. This attitude of self-centeredness is going to come back and get us, because self-centeredness simply destroys itself.
Well, I've never heard it put that way before, that people are not as much pro-life as they are pro-birth, yeah, which is true if you don't want to spend the money in order to take care of the children once the children are here.
Why don't you want to spend the money? Because you want the tax break. But you don't want to pay for education in this country. That's going to come back and bite us, because people can't afford it anymore, and we're going to pretty soon be without a level of intellectualism in this country that can bring us beyond all of these issues.
But it boils down to, again, your beautiful articulation of national self-centeredness. What got us to here? How did we lose our way? Or does it even matter at this moment how we got here?
Well, we got here because we have managed to keep the population happy without educating them to the under issue. We started there. This is where it comes from. This whole notion that the successful person is the person who can sustain themselves without caring for anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up.
You say on page 46, the pressure to be quiet, because that's what's happening. It's the silenced people, the people not speaking up. And we see this from Congress to our very own neighborhoods, mm-hmm, right?
Oh, yes.
The pressure to be quiet, to let other people, the politicians, the neighbors, the experts, say how we feel about things is very effective. And then on page 54, you say, it's finding the courage to utter the first word of truth in public that takes all the strength we can muster. It's learning to say quietly, unequivocally, I think differently about that.
It's the most subversive thing you can do.
I think differently about that.
I think differently about that. Yeah. Just say it. That shouldn't take courage. That should be part of the soul of humanity waiting to hear the insights of someone else's soul. But you see how quickly we responded as a people to, we're going to win and win and win until you're sick of winning. We're not here to win. We're here to grow. We're here to develop. We're here to leave the world a better place when we go, because we've been here. And you only do that through civil discourse.
And you only do that when everybody wins.
That's right.
Only you're winning, nobody else can win.
You and I could sit here in front of a good poker table, and we could put an issue on the table, and we may find, the more we talk, that, I never thought of it that way. Or, I don't think that's going to work. Okay, tell me why you think it's... Civil discourse takes us into the heart of something so that we can come out of it with more heart and more mind than we had before.
Which is one of the beautiful reasons and rewards for me all those years during the Oprah Show, and why I continue to have these conversations, is to create those moments where I love that when that happens. I love it when it happens to me, and I love it when it happens to someone else. I never thought of it that way before. When you get to the, I never thought of it that way before. My mind gets to open up, get to expand a little bigger. Oh. My heart gets more open. I never thought of it that way before.
Well, you look at yourself in the mirror and you say, who grew me like this?
Yes.
When they say, Oprah, how did you get where you are?
Yeah.
The answer is, I listened to you.
Yes.
I listened to everything
around
me.
So many voices. Yes, yes, yes.
And I became a bigger, grander, better person.
Person because of it.
I hope I'm allowed to say this because it's so meaningful and serious for me. You realize, I'm going to go back. If you and I were back in the third century, we'd be sitting on the porch of one of the Greek temples.
Right.
And we would be talking about, what do you think beauty is? What is kindness? What is love? What is a government? We would be using one another to flesh out the facet of this diamond of life. We don't do that anymore. We fight.
Mm-hmm.
We fight. Everything is an angry disputation. I'm right, you're wrong. As a result, you, my dear philosopher, have the only good program that we've ever had. You have saved thought in this nation for years. We're so divided. We're segmented. We do not see, that's why I talk about the separation of mind and soul.
Yes.
You can talk about anything in your mind, and you can get away with it. But you cannot say a spiritual idea and where it came from and have anybody listen with respect in this country.
It's true. It's true. And I think you're right. This show is one of the only places I know where people have a discourse about ideas that are related to the soul and to the heart and trying to expand that. So thank you for that acknowledgement. You write about how moral decisions impact our spirituality on page 60. You say we're in a moral moment again. Every moment is a moral moment because every moment involves a decision. The point is that we cannot now stop asking these questions and be authentically spiritual. It's a moral moment.
It's a moral moment.
Yeah.
And every moral moment demands a choice, which is why I talk very early in the book, I think.
Yeah, you start the book. That is, we have a choice.
About choice.
Yes, we have a choice.
We have a choice.
Yes.
And every great moral moment gives you three opportunities. And you can see them very clearly in our society. The first kind of choice is the choice that says, not me, I'm not getting into that.
Mm-hmm.
Let them handle it. That's not my problem. I'm out of here. I got the kids and the horses and the ponies and the racetrack.
I've got the square footage and the pool and the car.
That's
and
it.
All the things.
I don't get into that political stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's your first choice,
yes.
Is to ignore it and go your own way as if you really are an independent member of society and humanity. Your second possible choice is to just, you can roll over.
Mm-hmm.
You can succumb. You say, Sister Joan, that's the way it is now. It's just different now. I'm not talking about going back to the 19th century, for God's sake. What would be good about that? I'm talking about making the 21st century a glowing, growing moment for everybody. That's all I want. However, the person who makes the choice to roll over says, let them do it. I'm sure it'll all come out all right. That's what they said in 1939. There was too much silence in 1939,
mm-hmm.
and it wrecked all of Europe. We're sitting in a cesspool of silence instead of getting into the national conversation, because only a moral national conversation can bring us through to another level of political humanity as well as spiritual humanity, which is your third choice. Your third choice is to deal with it. Study it, develop it, form a group, join a group, support something, say, this is how I want to do my part in this development.
Yeah, get engaged in some way.
Coming up,
you say on page 99 of The Time Is Now, after we've said our prayers and checked the news, shaken our heads over it and turned off the TV, commentators in despair and disgust, which I hear so many people talking about, we suddenly remember someone who needs the help we've just read about. Then we ask ourselves what we really stand for and what we've done to prove it. At that moment, we either become prophets or simply churchgoers. And that is the ultimate question, the question we all must answer. And you, what are you going to do about it?
It's that simple, Oprah. It's not complex.
Yeah. This was a wake-up call for me. I mean, I read this and I thought, gee, I am not doing enough.
Oh, dear.
I am not doing enough. I am not doing enough. And you're going to see a change, even with me. I'm telling you. I was so moved by this book and so proud of you for having the courage to tell us how we are headed for real despair.
That's right.
And real trouble. Yes. We are in trouble, America. We are in trouble.
Serious trouble.
And everybody talks about it in the pundits. And what bothers me so is that the left and the right are equally hysterical.
Oh, yes.
And solving absolutely nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. We need a political moment where they sit down and have just one weekly conversation on what are we here for
What can we do? And so where do we begin? I love the turning off, because everybody's had that moment. I don't watch the news particularly at night, but you shake your head and you think, somebody ought to do something, and then you get in bed and you forget about it.
So I've been kind of a news freak all my life, right? And now I see this moment happening around me, and I'm out with these wonderful groups of people, and I have discovered two things. You either don't dare say one word because it will split this thing right down the middle instead of opening a conversation that is grasping.
People feel this even in their own families. You can't bring it up.
No. Thanksgiving is more fraught than it's ever been in history.
Yes.
And then you find yourself without a country, without a home, without a planet. And I began to hear people say, I don't watch the news anymore. I just can't take it. It's too much. It makes me nervous. I get tense. And I said, there it is, John. Nobody is discussing anything. And discussing it has become debating it, and debating it has become win or lose. And so here we are.
Yeah, you're only debating it to prove that I'm right.
That's right.
Yes.
And I'm simply saying to people, would you pick this stuff up? Would you read it seriously? And if you're not a reader, would you find somebody who is, who sit down, bring five people together, say, what is going on here? How can we help? What do we need to do? Get in to the public conversation.
Yeah, that is what you're saying. The time is now to do.
Yeah.
And if you don't, this moment is going to pass us by, and the moment is going to get worse.
Well, how many more years do you think we can go relieving ourselves of the responsibility to check on our own representatives, senators, local commissioners, everybody? They're there for us. What are they doing? What did they do in the township? What did it do to the
township? Well, and all the silence is because people just want to keep their jobs. They want to more interested in being popular than they actually are in serving the public. And they think if they speak their own truth, they will no longer have the position.
I was just going to say, it is a popularity in the truest sense of the emotional meaning.
I was going to say, if you could say anything to, you know, the people in government now, but it's not the people in government, it's actually us.
It's us. And what I would want to say to us is clear. We're at a transition moment. It's obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I started with that. The world as I grew up in it, the world that taught me, is no longer with us. We are facing now this misty gray. What happens on the other side of this bridge, we will build. We will either build or not build.
Yeah.
What we want to have happen, we have got to begin to press for, not in any angry way, but in an obvious and open and loving way.
What you encourage us to do is to use anger as a holy moment.
Oh,
yes.
I see anger as grace. I'm a woman. Don't tell me not to be angry about the suppression of women everywhere, all colors, all languages, all places. I know what women are living in. And I wouldn't give up that anger for anything. It's fuel. It will keep me going in behalf of women 10 inches away from the edge of the grave. I will not stop. Because without that anger, we're losing half the human race.
Yes.
We have half the human race deciding what the other half should do.
Well, you must also be very angry about how the Catholic Church, in particular, has treated women, how the Catholic Church has looked at abuse, moving people from diocese to diocese. I mean, you must be very angry about those
things. Well, I can't tell you. I mean, that's just almost without, there are no words for that. How do I deal with it? I see the institution and its 2,000-year history.
Yes.
This institution split 400 years ago over exactly that kind of stuff. And then I see the Jesus story. And I know I was raised in this institution that had kept the Jesus story for me. For that, I'll always be grateful. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want for the church. And I will keep pressing for it in the church. And no, it is not fully alive there yet and has been disgraced in many ways. But this story drives me on, this Jesus story. And now what will
the whole Jesus
do? The whole Jesus.
What you've left us here with today, and I thought so profound, is a lot of people want to follow the healing Jesus.
Yes.
Yeah, not the Jesus that it encompasses and opens himself, itself, the Christ self, to every living human being.
Jesus the prophet. The one who confronted those who were oppressing any part of church or society in his time, fearlessly.
The virtual life you speak of on page 70 resonates so authentically with me. You say, in this era, we watch con men define themselves as wealthy, when their accountants know that they owe more than they could ever pay. We watch politicians posturing from one interview to the next, pretending to have answers, though nothing changes for the people they serve. We see television personalities posing as experts, as if they really had the influence with which they are being credited. We watch bureaucrats in big cars pretending to be important. What is it that is really real? Is all of life virtual now, seldom actual, always part scam, part play? Still the world goes on, yearning for the genuine. So beautifully said. And so as we yearn for the genuine, each of us has to look for that within our own selves and step up to what you call uncommon courage.
Uncommon courage. The courage we're not seeing now. That simple, honest, truthful, sincere moment when I'm able to say, I think differently about that.
Sister Joan, thank you so much.
You.
God bless you for this sermon this morning.
Well,
thank you for the sermon.
Wow. Thanks, Tim, for running that for us. The core questions that I'd like you all to think about when Tim breaks us up into our reflective groups comes from chapter 3. She writes about Mary Oliver and that wonderful phrase, instruction for living a life. Mary Oliver says, pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. Well, that's what we've been asked to do for this 40-some minutes of the interview between Sister Joan and Oprah. I'm sure you are all paying attention. I have seen this now two or three times, and there's so much new in it every time I look at it. You're going to want to see this again yourselves. But pay attention to what is both those women are saying. Be astonished by the insights and revelations that have come forth this morning. Feel that and then tell about your response to it. And that is the call to all of us to respond, to say, what our own truth is about this. So those are the three little instructions for our reflection group. I'm hoping that there'll be time enough for us to go around our circle, or you, Tim usually puts us together with what, three or four people, many times, so that we will say, this really moved me. And I didn't understand it. I had not heard it that way before. And this is what it stirs me to think. That's the best way, I think, that we can begin to debrief from this remarkable chance to listen to the two great souls talking to each other this morning. So, Tim, over to you to break us into our reflective groups, where we will listen, pay attention, be astonished, and tell about it.
Sounds great. Thanks, Pat.
My trust is that for all of you, your reflection group will have been as profound and moving as ours was. I met new friends, and we opened each other up because of what we'd heard this morning. We have maybe one or two moments. If anybody has a burning comment, I would love to hear some last words, maybe two or three, and then I'll tell us where we're going next. But anyone who really heard something that they want to share with us this morning, raise your hand and let's hear it. All right. I think that having heard and spoken at a little longer length than we ordinarily do probably gave us a chance for us to express what we've been feeling this morning. Joan Chittister is a force of nature for social justice and a fervent proponent of personal faith and spiritual action. We met her face to face this morning, and I think we've all been touched by that encounter. Next week, we'll be reading chapters 3 on awareness and chapters 4 on insight. These are short but wonderfully on target observations about how to mature in our faith and action. We look forward to what next week's speaker, the Reverend Steve Jacobson, will bring to Chittister's urgent messages. And we'll look forward to seeing you next Thursday for what promises to be a very lively morning. So Steve Jacobson, chapters 3 and 4, and we will see you then. Have a good
time to say goodbye.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you to the new friends you met in the reflection room.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.